Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome a new guest co-host, Dr. Shannon Ames. Welcome, Shannon. You excited to be here?
Oh, very much so.
We are excited to have you. Shannon is one of our great fellows in our preventive medicine program and has just tremendous experience. And we're going to get a chance today to use that experience as we're talking with Dr. Chandra Ford, associate professor in the Department of Community Health Sciences at UCLA and founding director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health, about her work to illuminate the effects of racism on health. You probably have seen some manifestations of this in your own training and work, have you not, Shannon?
I have.
Yeah, it's always hard. This is a hard area to go, and I'm excited that we can talk about it openly on with your health listeners.
I agree. I think it's something that needs to be spoken about more.
Well, first we're going to speak about some research that matters, and let's dive right in. The first research is about diet drinks. And I got to be honest with you, I do like my Diet Coke more than I like Coca-Cola. Should I be worried?
Well, I think that it's something that we should think about, especially when people drink as much diet drinks as they do.
Yeah, this is a research, and we've actually talked about some of the research about some of the health problems associated with diet drinks and things like diabetes. And this is research that was in the Journal of the American Heart Association, their subspecialty journal called Stroke. And it was the association between diet drinks and strokes among postmenopausal women. Tell us a little bit more about this, Shannon.
Well, it seemed that compared to women who drank less than once a week or not at all, women who drank two or more of these artificially sweetened beverages were at an increased risk to have a stroke or a clot-associated or ischemic stroke.
Yeah, so these were those who had two or more of these artificially sweetened beverages per day. I thought initially it was like per week or per month. I was like, well, that would be a lot of people. And it's still a lot of people because I know a lot of people drink two or more a day. And like you said, it was 23% more likely to have a stroke, 31% more likely to have a clot, 29% more likely to have heart disease, and 16% more likely to die from any cause. That got my attention.
Yeah, it did mine too. But I think the key word is that it was associated with.
Right, not causality. We can't say that the drinks caused this. They did adjust for common things associated with strokes and heart attacks, things like high blood pressure or smoking or diabetes or obesity, because this was a research that they were looking at over 81,000 postmenopausal women in the Women's Health Initiative. We've talked about that study lots on this show, and they can't say really what the mechanism is or if it's really causal or what types of diet drinks. Would my diet ginger ale do it? Oh, I hope not.
Well, and they also don't talk about what else these women are taking in besides the diet drinks and also how active they are. And so, you know, there may be other factors involved.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is the American Heart Association recommends what drink as the best choice for a no-calorie beverage. What do you think that drink is?
Water.
Water. H2O. We don't think there's any risk of that. I think that's an important research. We'll actually ask our health science librarians to make sure they put a link up on this for our listeners who would like to look at it themselves. Let's talk about our next research that matters, and it's about Pinterest. Do you go on Pinterest, Shannon?
I used to a lot.
You used to. Well, you wouldn't be alone. 80% of mothers and 38% of fathers are on Pinterest. And I've been on it. My daughter got me interested in it. And there are over 250 million monthly active users. That alone's not a problem. Why do we care about things like Pinterest and, in this case, vaccinations?
Well, it seems that people have been using Pinterest to promote their anti-vaccination beliefs.
Yeah. This is interesting because it's a platform of communicating, in this case, a lot of times to young mothers who might have young children. And it appears that it's been particularly active as a platform for what might call vaccination doubters, people who don't believe the vaccination data, to put out articles, to put out views, many of which, maybe not all, but many of which are false. They would be called fake news at some levels. And there was pressure actually put on Pinterest, and they decided to actually change the way they allow vaccine search results in order to curb a spread of misinformation. What did they do?
It looks like they used algorithms to identify these messages and prevent them from being as easily searched for.
Right. So this is really kind of to help curb what the World Health Organization has called vaccine hesitancy, one of the kind of they call a major threat to global health. We do know that there have been increasing spread of outbreaks. Most people would know the increase in measles, the spread of measles. There were 72 adults and children in Europe alone last year who died from measles, a completely almost avoidable public health disease, and yet measles reached its highest level in two decades. And so the misinformation, what types of things do you think people could hear that might be misinformation that Pinterest and maybe other social media platforms like Google or YouTube or Twitter, Facebook might be interested in also curbing?
Well, I think one of the problems is that they overestimate the risk of getting the vaccines and maybe underestimate the benefits of getting these vaccines.
Yeah, so most parents will be worried about side effects, potentially the costs, maybe any objections morally or religiously. People would know, but hopefully not believe the kind of the debunking about, you know, measles and autism and just general knowledge. And so all of these things could be subject to misinformation. I admit I was a little hesitant to think about what does it mean to make restrictions. But it's not like these platforms are curb your own First Amendment. It just says their platforms are their own platforms. You don't have an unfettered right to put whatever you want on their platform.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thought, and that they're just trying to make sure that the information that's on there is accurate.
Yeah, well, we're going to, again, we invite other views and thoughts about this, but we would encourage it to be based on current facts. Speaking of facts, our next Research That Matter is about cervical cancer and the HPV vaccination, that there's a new study out that looks to model, to develop these economic models to look at, could we get rid of cervical cancer by the year 2100 in essentially 80 years? I just thought this was very exciting.
Yeah, I think so, too, especially considering that cervical cancer not very long ago was a major cause of disease in women.
Yeah, it's still the number four cause of cancer deaths among women after breast cancer and probably ovarian cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer. These are up there. But, you know, cervical cancer is right there. But in order to get rid and to make this essentially a curable disease, we have to raise vaccination rates across the globe. I think it'd be hard-pressed to say we shouldn't do that. You know, is it a woman's choice at a certain age to do this, or is it a parent's choice? Well, these are some policy decisions. But right now, we have the technology. We could get rid of the overwhelming majority of it. I think it's a good idea.
I agree.
Let's talk about our last research that matters and see if we also agree on this, which is an interesting research. I can't believe it's the very first time they talk about doing it, but it's to treat depression in prisoners through a randomized controlled trial. What do they do?
Well, it seems that they had some colleagues that were trained to treat inmates with interpersonal psychotherapy in a manner that was effective but also cost effective.
Right. So, you know, so many prisoners, and I think there's over 2 million people that are in prison every day, get out of prison and their depression's not treated. And we know that depression not treated leads to suicides. It leads to could lead to violence. It can lead to poor mental health, all kinds of bad outcomes. And we all end up paying for that. And they may not even have insurance when they come out or access to primary care. So, yeah, why not treat it when they're in prison? And this data was really important and showed it was effective and cost-effective. This was in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology. What do you think the ramifications and implications are of this, Shannon?
Well, I think that, one, it treats a common disease that affects millions of people, and also it may improve the outcomes of the inmates once they're released back into society so that they're able to get jobs and be functional and get back on with their lives.
I think this is a standard of care game changer. I think we should demand it to be in all of our prisons and this to be offered for anyone and everyone who needs access to depression treatment. We all pay for it if it doesn't happen.
I agree.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Chandra Ford, Associate Professor at UCLA and Founding Director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health, about her work to illuminate the effects of racism on health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Shannon Ames. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Shannon Ames. Today on Conversation, Shannon, we're talking with Dr. Chandra Ford, Associate Professor in the Department of Community Health Sciences at UCLA and Founding Director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health, about her work to illuminate the effects of racism on health. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Ford.
Thank you for having me.
It's a real delight to have you on the show about an issue that I consider one of the most important in all of medicine today that a lot of people are concerned about, but I don't think a lot of people really understand. And we're going to dive deep into that. But first, I think we'd like to know a little bit about you. How did you get interested in medicine, and what's your path to where you are today?
Well, you know, I didn't always think that I would be studying something like racism as a public health issue. I actually started out in clinical nutrition, and I was heading towards that clinical direction, but I experienced what I considered to be forms of racism that really intrigued me personally as a student. And I believe, looking back now, that those experiences helped to shape my trajectory over the long haul and led me to pursue, really just out of intellectual curiosity, this work on experiences of racism, experiences of inequality, and how they might affect the well-being of people.
Can you share something that comes to mind that you experienced that was influential to you personally?
You know, something that many people have experienced is having a loved one who is really sick. And for me, I was accompanying a very dear family member to clinical visits, and the kind of treatment that my loved one received sometimes felt very disrespectful and certainly was not what I would anticipate or expect based on my own knowledge about public health, about health care, and about what the patient should be receiving. And that was extremely hurtful, it felt like to me. And it made me want to understand not just, you know, why clinicians or clinical staff members, you know, so some of the folks who might do something or not do something that feels unkind or hurtful to the patients might not be doing it intentionally. But I really wanted to understand, I think I wanted to move some of that pain and sadness from a personal place to try to figure out what could I do to help address these kinds of things so that other families don't experience the same thing.
And we've talked a lot about implicit bias on this show, from what I understand. Can you tell us a little bit about what the difference between implicit bias and healthcare and racism is?
this is an area where there's a lot of conversation in the field. When we talk about implicit bias, and nowadays a lot of times people think about it in terms of policing. We've heard a lot about that in the news, about implicit bias leading officers, for example, to think that an African-American young man is a suspect in a really short period of time. It's important in terms of the research to think about implicit biases as not just random biases like, well, I like apples and he likes pears and we're just different like that, but rather to recognize that the biases that we hold inside that are unconscious to us are actually shaped by, you know, the structures and organizations, the cultures of those structures and organizations within which we operate. And so it's not just a function of changing individuals' implicit biases, but rather changing a culture so that the biases are shaped in different directions. And essentially we're reshaping the biases, that they're not adverse to any group, but they're actually more constructive. In terms of the difference between implicit bias and racism, there are several things to think about. One is that some critical race theorists, these are scholars and researchers who really focus their work specifically on trying to tear apart this idea about race and racism and really figure it out. These folks are saying that maybe we shouldn't call implicit bias implicit bias. Maybe we should call it implicit racism. The whole reason for referring to the implicit nature of it is to say, not that we don't also have overt biases, but that the implicit ones are another set of biases that act in other, in fact, predictable ways, but that we're unaware of. And so implicit bias is actually just one of many different ways that racism operates. You can think of it as one way that racism operates at the individual level, so that individuals might participate in racism unknowingly. And that's on top of any ways that they might participate knowingly. One thing that's really, really interesting about implicit or unconscious forms of racism is that often folks like us in public health, the implicit forms of racism are actually the ones that are most concerning, because people who truly espouse egalitarian principles and folks who really are interested in doing good are actually particularly susceptible to the implicit forms of racism. These are not the folks who are going to do any sort of overt calling someone a racial slur or anything like that. And perhaps because they would never do something and never even want to do anything overtly racist, they may be unaware of the ways that they can continue to subtly do things that in fact are discriminatory towards people.
We're talking with Dr. Chandra Ford, founding director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health. And Dr. Ford, before we take a break, one of the things I've been so impressed with myself is really seeing all these statistics that really show disparities in care for African Americans and African American men and African American women across so many what we call the social determinants. They persist, though. And I wasn't quite certain fully how they operate till I saw two of my patients experience, or at least I thought they probably experienced this sort of bias, when there were assumptions that led other doctors to question perhaps symptoms of chest pain or heart disease or other things that I didn't see that my white patients might experience. And I just wondered, was this at play?
Yeah. That might actually be an example of implicit bias at work. So if we were to assume that there was really this sort of difference happening unbeknownst to the provider, so it's not that the provider is trying to be mean, but that the provider genuinely does not even see how certain assumptions are informing the care that they're providing. It's almost like we kind of have to be a little overprotective in a way, because our tendency would be to be underprotective of certain groups.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. Well, we're going to need to take a short break. When we come back in, I'd love to hear more about your center, about the research you're doing, about some of the solutions that you're proposing. We'll be right back talking with Dr. Chandra Ford, associate professor in the Department of Health Sciences at UCLA and the founding director of the Center for Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Chandra Ford, associate professor in the Department of Community Health Sciences at UCLA and founding director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health, about her work to illuminate the effects of racism on health.
So, Dr. Ford, could you tell us just a little bit more about the Center for Study of Racism and Social Justice and Health and its mission and how it got started?
Absolutely. So, you know, there's been a growing body of literature around the issue of racism within the context of public health. So this has been going on for like the last 10 years, at least, maybe the last 20 years. That literature has been growing very rapidly. But there's a lot of variability. You know, some studies are really great and others are requiring a lot more work in terms of the rigor. And that's true with any field. And so if we are to improve our understandings about how something as potentially controversial as racism actually affects health, we need to be very careful and deliberate about how we do the work that we do on this topic. So in 2017, on Indigenous Peoples Day, in fact, the very first Indigenous Peoples Day in Los Angeles, and by Indigenous Peoples Day, I mean that formerly that was Columbus Day, but in 2017, we launched the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health. There are numerous faculty, students, staff, and community members who are involved with the center in a myriad of ways. And for the most part, we serve as a hub for people who are interested in studying these questions about social inequalities and how they affect health, and especially those tied to racism. And let me say that when I use the term racism, I'm not just talking about black and white issues. We're talking about things like anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-immigrant sentiment, and nativism. We have folks working on the ways that American Indians and First Nation people have been affected by what they define as colonialism or imperialism. So we use the term racism, but we're really trying to improve how our field of public health addresses social inequalities as public health issues.
I wonder if you can give us an example from one of your research. I know that you did and participated in an important paper in one of the major obstetrics and gynecology journals about endometrial cancer disparities, a race-conscious critique of the literature. What was the critique?
The critique in that study was really that the understandings that we have about endometrial cancer, they reflect the body of literature that hasn't critiqued race. So there's a lot of jargon that I don't think is necessary to get into here about what is it that race represents in the literature? What is it that race represents when a patient comes before us? Is it their biology? Is it something about their culture? In this paper, we really were focused on how most of the literature in this area has failed, in many ways failed Black women who experience endometrial cancer because it hasn't taken more seriously the inequalities that race represents when patients show up, like what is it that they're showing up with? So it's not that black race reflects some sort of inherent risk for this cancer or for other conditions. It's really that it's a signal that there's something wrong in the social environment that individual women are at greater risk for.
So it seems like this is just a really challenging problem to tackle. Based on your research and what you've learned, do you have any examples of successful approaches that can improve the health outcomes in these situations?
You know, there really are lots of opportunities for improvement. And actually, I would say there are lots of opportunities for making tiny interventions that could go a long ways toward improvement. One example is a study that was led by Billy Cunningham, who's also one of the center affiliates. And this is a project that I had the privilege to collaborate with him on. And what the project did was, in an effort to improve how patients with HIV do over the long term, the study developed and implemented this intervention that involved a data exchange system. So, for instance, after a particular type of clinical visit, the provider enters some information into this information exchange, and the information exchange system prompts the provider through the electronic medical record system to provide the next step. So it guides the provider in making sure that all patients get similar opportunities for referrals, prescriptions, and those kinds of things. What that does is it takes away some of the discretion of the provider, not necessarily in a bad way, but it serves as a check to make sure that if the provider doesn't automatically think that a particular patient might need a referral or might warrant a particular prescription, it provides a prompt for the provider to sort of at least think for a moment about that and then move forward from there. What's really exciting about this study, which was published in JADE, the Journal of Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, is that it showed the intervention actually reduced the amount of adverse outcomes for all patients. So it improved, for instance, how efficiently patients received their prescriptions for antiretroviral therapy medication. But importantly, it also reduced the black, white, and also Latino white disparities. And that's important because a lot of times the disparities related research is different, and what's known to be effective for addressing disparities is not necessarily known to be effective for improving overall health outcomes. This study shows that we can do things that improve health for everyone, and also, in the course of doing that, address, reduce disparities. Another is the lack of information, the lack of data is a major problem, because much of the data that has been generated does not reflect the racism-focused information needs that our center is really concerned with. Another one of our affiliates, Randall Aki, he's been working on creating measures of mortality, for instance, for First Nations people, essentially the same as American Indian people in Canada. So what he's found so far is that they have high rates of mortality, but they often are not reported due to lack of appropriate measures.
What's exciting about your research, many things, but you've given us a great example of what individual practitioners can do, which is essentially to err on the side of perhaps going a little bit more on the other side of where they might go. You've told us a systems issue, a health systems issue that can be done, a simple one that can affect and improve health for everyone, but also address this issue. What can patients do to maybe help us all come together and deal with this?
You know, one of the things I think is really helpful for patients to know, and actually for the general public to know, is that there's a way in which patients feel like they're doing the wrong thing, especially those from minority communities who constantly receive that message. So the ways that studies are done presents that message. I believe there's a lot of empowerment that can happen as a result of becoming more aware of this literature. So not just information about which pills to take or, you know, how often to seek their preventive care. Those things are important. But I also think that community members and patients can learn that actually they are making the best decisions that they can make given the information they have. So far, the literature suggests some share of the adverse outcomes that patients experience are tied to things that they're not doing wrong. And I just want to encourage patients to know that we do know that they're trying to do the best they can do with the information that they have, and then to try to encourage them to go further. And then sometimes, since we're talking about members of communities who are often socially marginalized, they may not realize that they do have options. So they don't have to rely upon clinicians or public health persons, professionals or others who treat them unfairly. And our data, my own research, even some of my earliest research, suggests that when patients perceive that, that oftentimes those perceptions do reflect attitudes or cultures within those organizations. So I would say also trust their own perceptions. And, you know, in that respect, I think, you know, I hope that that offers some encouragement to patients to realize they're not just the subject of public health efforts and medical efforts, but they can be more active in choosing spaces and providers and service providers that are supportive of them.
Well, we want to tell you, Dr. Chandra Ford, thank you for trusting us with your expertise and trusting your health listeners to take this and to go with it. And I might say that I know you're the founding director of the Center for Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health. And if I could, I'd add another word in there, the Center for the Study and Empowerment for Making Changes in Racism, Social Justice, and Health, because that's what I hear you doing. So thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Chandra Ford, UCLA and founding director of the Center for Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Shannon Ames. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Shannon and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health concerns and questions. If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I recently had a mole on my shoulder that my doctor said needed to come off. They were clearly worried about melanoma. He took the mole off and called me and said he'd gotten all of the mole, but it was severely dysplastic, and he recommended I see a surgeon to have further work done. Why would I need to have additional surgery if he got all the bad skin?
Well, first off, I'm so glad that mole got off.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Because it's so easy to see a mole and say, you know, is it abnormal? Is it not abnormal? That word dysplastic, what does that really mean? Let's put it into simple language.
The way that I would explain it is that it's cells that are atypical from normal cells, and they're a little concerning, and it definitely needs to come off.
Right, because it's not like it's just atypical, like it looks a little bad. This looked really bad, and it was almost cancer. You know, certainly there's some controversy about does just plastic lead to cancer, but certainly sometimes the differentiation between, you know, a cancer and a precancer, severely dysplastic, because that's right before melanoma potentially. So I think in this particular case, your doctor's saying they got it all. When the pathologist looks at it under a microscope, it looks around the edge. You know, it says, you know, is that water within 10 feet of your house? No, the water's not. So therefore, you know, the flood didn't come in. But maybe just look over the corner and maybe 15 feet from your house, there's water. Maybe that's too close. Maybe there's water coming in from it. So you don't know to what extent is that water, are those abnormal cells creeping up, and they want to take it further away to really be sure. And would you do that? Would you want that done for you if you had a severely dysplastic mole?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah. And in this particular case, the shoulder could be a tough little area to do surgery on. So they might send you to either a plastic surgeon or a dermatologic specialist called a Mohs surgeon so they can take the least amount of tissue and actually have a cure rate of over 99%.
That sounds great.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I have a problem that I'm curious if others also have. I went in to see my doctor and they put me on a medicine and it seemed to help. My skin condition, rosacea, got better after 2 months, so I stopped the medication, but then it came back. Should I start the medicine again? And if so, how long should I be on it this time?
Nope, you're the only person in the entire world that has that problem. We've never heard of that before, have we, Shannon?
Actually, it's pretty common.
Oh, come on.
Much like a lot of chronic diseases, it's something that you may have to treat for many years, if not forever.
Right. So things like acne, we oftentimes think of that, you know, you have to be on the medicine, sometimes the antibiotics, sometimes the creams. It gets better and you stop it and you go, it came back. Well, it's a chronic disease. It's not something that we can easily cure. Things like psoriasis, diabetes, high blood pressure. But people don't think of skin diseases sometimes like that, do they?
No, they don't. And another common one is eczema that seems to come and go depending on the season, and you feel like you have it under control and then it comes back.
Yeah. In this particular case, I think it's important that the doctor spends some time talking with you about the likelihood of needing to be on it. I usually say you need to be on it for at least 6 months. Then we can talk about it, but I want to see you back in 6 months because maybe if your rosacea was so bad and it got so good, maybe you'd like to stay on it for a year before we attempt to draw it. Because once it comes back, you're going to have 6 to 8 weeks before we get it back into control again.
Definitely.
Thanks for the question. And here's to trying to be on the least amount of medicine for the least amount of time, but maybe not stopping it too soon as it could easily happen. What's our very next house call, Laura?
I get really anxious, and I know it's probably more than normal. My sister, however, was recently diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and while I'm, of course, overwhelmed for her sake, I also get the feeling that anytime I'm getting a headache or an abnormal pain, that maybe I have cancer too. What can I do about this?
Well, you're not alone. I would say that most people, when they're confronted with someone they love, someone they know, having serious medical illness, it's really normal to consciously or subconsciously think about your own health, particularly when someone's dying.
Yeah, I think that it's very common, and sometimes anxiety can manifest itself in really interesting ways. Sometimes not being able to sleep, sometimes getting stressed about things that normally wouldn't cause stress in your life, and also getting frustrated with people that you normally wouldn't get frustrated with.
So ranging from physical symptoms, even chest pain can happen, to having panic attacks, to being depressed and anxious. These are natural reactions. Sometimes they call them adjustment disorders, as if, you know, that everyone goes through something, I think, in these things, and that would be natural. However, in this particular circumstance, it may be that it's a little bit beyond what's natural. In this particular case, maybe you're starting to have panic attacks or having anxiety intrude. How do you know, Shannon, when someone maybe needs to get some help from their primary care doctor or a therapist in this circumstance?
I think that when it's affecting your life in multiple different areas and it's causing a major impact in the quality of your life would be a sign that you need to seek some help.
Well, we want to say thank you for all of our listeners today for some really good house call questions. We hope we've provided answers and addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can visit us online and share your own stories or questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can go to yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our great guest co-host, Dr. Shannon Ames, and our guest today, Dr. Chandra Ford. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Shannon Ames.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill. 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.